Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Janice Matias.
My mother looks me in the eye. She says, "You have to learn to be a big girl." My mother exposed her poom-poom to me. Her poom-poom did not look like my poom-poom.
That and more, but before that, we are still taking pitches for our July 30th show in Detroit, Michigan, and our July 31st show in Chicago. If you are anywhere near Detroit or Chicago, pitch us your story. If you know someone who is anywhere near Detroit or Chicago who you think might have a great story to share, have them pitch us. Stories can be funny, scary, beautiful, anything. As you know, the theme is this incident you're taking us into, were you emotionally invested? Does it feel revealing? Does it feel kind of like you're coming outside of your comfort zone to be sharing this in public? Or is it just really meaningful to you? We always zero in on particular incidents like the weekend that this happened or the morning that that happened. There's lots of wonderful tips on how to pitch us and how to start mulling over a story on the Risk website, risk-show.com/submissions. There's also the storytelling resources page at risk-show.com/storytelling-resources with little tutorials, little videos, you know, 4 minutes each, just giving tips on particular storytelling techniques. And of course, we coach our storytellers. We help you prepare. So if you thought that the deadline was passed for getting in a pitch for Detroit or Chicago, Detroit on July 30th, Chicago on July 31st, the deadline has not passed. Pitch us your stories. Go to risk-show.com/submissions. Now here's the show. Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. This is ESG behind me now. And we're calling this week's episode Discovery. So many stories are about people making new discoveries or discovering stuff they thought they already knew. Our first story comes to us from one of our favorites, Mark Redmond. Mark has a phenomenal memoir. The title of it is Called. It's always just a little confusing to say that because people say, called what? Well, it's called Called. And you can find out more at markredmondbooks.com. Here is Mark now with a story we call What's Credit?
In 1985, I was living in New York City. I had a part-time job at Catholic Charities. They had just created a new office to deal with homelessness in New York City. And homelessness was a new phenomenon in America at that point. And one day, I just happened to pick up the phone. It rang, and the person calling was a priest. He was a Jesuit priest. His name was Father Bill McNichols. And that he was ministering to men with AIDS who were homeless. And AIDS was fairly new in 1985 as well. And AIDS at that point was a death sentence. There were no drugs to treat AIDS. If you had AIDS, it was a cruel, horrible death. And men were being kicked out of their homes because people didn't understand AIDS. It was terrible discrimination and ending up on the street. And Father Bill was helping them. And he wanted to start a residence for homeless men with AIDS. somewhere in New York City. In fact, he even had a building on Christopher Street. It was a convent at St. Veronica's. And St. Christopher Street was really the center of the LGBT community in New York City at that point. And I asked him, well, why that particular building? Why that convent? Expecting he would say, well, it's got the right zoning or the right number of rooms. Instead, he said to me that St. Veronica was the one who comforted Jesus as he was carrying his cross on the way to his death, and that he wanted to comfort these men who had AIDS on the way to their death. And when I heard that, I knew that I was talking to someone who really lived on a very special spiritual plane, different from most people. So I met him a few days later at the St. Veronica's convent, and he was a young guy, long hair. He later told me he was gay. And he also brought with him a nun, Sister Patrice, who worked at St. Vincent's Hospital, which is a couple of blocks away. And St. Vincent's Hospital in the 80s was the main hospital helping people with AIDS. They were really doing heroic work. So we went through the convent, and really, it was perfect for what they wanted to do. So I left. I went back to my office, and I wrote up this proposal. And I sent it to this Monsignor, who's like a super priest in the Catholic Church. He headed up Catholic Charities. And honestly, I thought I was onto something really important here. And I was proud to have my name attached to it. You know, I was proud to write this proposal and be affiliated with this whole project. So I didn't hear back from this Monsignor. So a few weeks later, I went to go see him. And he said something like, oh, yeah, we're checking into that. A few months later, I'm at home watching the local news on TV, and I hear the announcer say, after the commercial, Catholic Charity's starting a residence for men with AIDS. So I'm thinking, this is great. This is happening. You know, our project is moving forward. Maybe I'll be in the New York Times soon. Who knows? Then the commercial ends. And there is the Monsignor standing in front of the St. Veronica's convent. No Father Bill, no Sister Patrice. And he says, oh, yes, Catholic Charities will be opening this up and Mother Teresa's nuns will be running this. And I went nuts. I called Father Bill. I called Father Patrice. They didn't hear or know what was going on. And I said, they took our idea. They cut us out. And they were angry too, but I would say more disappointed. I was pissed. I mean, I was just ballistic. So I quit my job at Catholic Charities. I sent this letter to the Monsignor. I wrote, I can't believe you did this. You took our idea, blah, blah, blah. And of course, I didn't hear back from him. 2 years later, I was on retreat with my father and my brothers, and we went to a retreat house, a Jesuit retreat house on Long Island. And when you go on retreat, there's always a retreat leader who gives talks. And this time it was an older Jesuit priest, a man probably in his late 70s, early 80s. He just had the air of kindness and wisdom. I remember he said he was a cancer survivor. So while I'm there that weekend, I see Father Bill McNichols. He's there too. So I went over to him, gave him a hug, caught up with him, told him my wife had a baby, everything's going well. So at some point in the retreat, you have a one-on-one session with the retreat leader. So that night, this older priest, you know, he knocks on the door and he comes in and you just, you know, he wants to know what's going on in your life. And I said, hey, I saw Father Bill McNichols here. And he says, oh, yeah, Bill McNichols, you know, great guy. And he asks, how do you know Bill? So I start telling him the story of the convent and St. Veronica's. And as I'm telling it, I'm getting all worked up. All the anger is coming. You can see that I'm pissed. So he says, did the residence open up? And I said, yes. He said, so homeless men with AIDS, they have a place to go. They're being taken care of. And I said, yeah, that's true. He said, so why are you so upset? And I said, well,
It was our idea. They stole our idea. We didn't get the credit.
And he looks at me and he smiles and he said, credit? What's credit? And I said, nothing. I said nothing. And those two words just kind of hung in the air. What's credit? And that was 35 years ago. That priest has passed away. So has Sister Patrice. So has the Monsignor. The retreat house closed. St. Veronica's church closed. I lost touch with Father Bill McNichols for a couple of decades, but then through the miracle of Facebook, we reconnected. He's out in Denver now. But that house for men with AIDS who are homeless is still there. It's at 149 Christopher Street in Manhattan. It's called The Gift of Love. And for the last 35 years, anytime I start to go down the road of, I was screwed, I did this great thing, I should have gotten the credit. Anytime I go down that road, I stop. And in my mind's eye, I can see the face of that kindly priest and I hear the words, what's credit?
Risk. This is Joe Walsh behind me now, and we just heard from Mark Redmond, and the editing on that one was done by Taj Easton. Now, there's a new bonus story going up on patreon.com/risk. This week, it's from Yves Saint Marie.
And then I had, like, fights with him in my head he would never answer because he's dead. But he would always judge. I will always feel him judging me.
That and so much more over at patreon.com/risk. Over 150 bonus stories, over 60 or so check-ins. I did one recently where I started to look back at some of your guys' testimonials on our 600th episode. And besides all the bonus content, you get to know that you are really and truly helping us out, and we really and truly need it and appreciate it to keep Risk running. And then, of course, if you want to make a one-time donation, that is at paypal.me/riskshow. Our final two stories on this week's episode are coming up in a little bit. We're going to hear from Aaliyah Liebenow, a story that she shared when Risk was in Portland, Oregon, about a month ago. But before that, a story from Janice Matias that Janice shared at a Risk live show in New York City over at Caveat. We have another one of those happening on June 23rd. You can find Janice Matias at janicematias.biz. She dedicated this story to her mother, Lucille Gonzalez Matias. Here's Janice now with a story we call A Rose in Spanish Harlem.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My story that I'm going to tell you today takes place in 1959 in New York City. I grew up in the Barrios. That's East, that was Spanish Harlem. During that time, New York City enforced strict segregation laws, making it impossible for people like me to associate or live with white people. My mother, who is African, Caribbean, Latina, had a gift of making money. She was able to rent a 5-room apartment, what we call in those days the best in the community, which was infected with rats, was decaying, but it was high class in the body, okay? So my mother was able to rent this 5-room apartment for my father, my brothers, and myself. It was during this time that I noticed that our standard of living was changing. I mean, we had the first color TV. My father was driving around with the latest Cadillac car. I had the first Barbie doll. Now, I knew that this was all because of my mother, Lucille Gonzalez Matias, and her relationship with our neighbor, Miss Gwendolyn, across the hall in apartment 12. Now, every weekend, my mother would spend her time over Miss Gwendolyn's house. I was responsible for taking care of the house and my siblings, but I'm nosy. So I remember at 7 years old, I used to peek out of my front door and I would see a group of women standing over Miss Gwendolyn's house. Some of them were nervous, some was crying. And one by one, they would go into Miss Gwendolyn, into her apartment, and I would hear cries and screams. I thought my mother, Miss Gwendolyn, was beating these women because they were bad. Now, during those days, I was forced to go to Catholic school for my communion, which was run by white nuns from Europe. And I remember as the head nun would stand in front of us and would take a ruler and rhythmically tap her palm of her hand as we recite, "I shall not fornicate." And I knew then at a young age that this body was evil. And because it was evil, it could make me evil because I'm a girl. One day when I was about 10 years old, I was coming home from school and our front door is usually unlocked, but this time it was locked. And I remember kicking the door and screaming, "Mommy!" And my mother flings open the door and she grabs me by the shoulder and she almost flings me into the apartment and she has this, well, let's put it this way. My favorite show that time was The Monster from the Black Lagoon. I don't know if that's that far away, huh? Yeah, but I loved it. And my mother looked like the white woman that saw the monster, okay? So later on, I heard my mother tell my father, the pigs have arrested Miss Gwendolyn because she killed a woman with a hanger, a wire hanger. Well, the pigs didn't come, or the police, but the women stopped coming. Time went by, and one night I remember I was laying in my bed, and my mother actually drags me in the middle of the night. The house is dark. She's holding a flashlight, and she guides me to the kitchen. She sits on the floor. She's doing something between her leg. I'm thinking, well, maybe we're going to have quality hour because she's always working. So I'm thinking, oh, we're going to play my favorite game, Jacks. So I kneel down. I look, and my mother looks me in the eye. She says, "You have to learn to be a big girl." When I look, my mother exposed her pum-pum to me. Her pum-pum did not look like my pum-pum. Her pum-pum had a tunnel. I remember she said to me, she handed me a soft rubber tube, and she said, "Look for the hole." I thought that was the game. So I find the hole and I insert, my mother moans, and then she slaps my hand, tells me to go to bed. I'm upset because now I don't know why I lost the game because I didn't know what the game was about anyway. She never talks about it. But soon after that, every time she would put a pot on the stove and make this kind of like a soup, a strange woman would appear in our house, and she would look nervous and sometimes crying. My mother would take the woman into her bedroom, carrying the pot and a bag. The woman would come out smiling, sometimes laughing, sometimes hugging my mother. I tasted what was in the pot, and my mother's a very good cook. I don't know what that was. But I said to myself, it must be a big girl thing. 1965, the Civil Rights Act, outlawing segregation, making it possible for my mother to buy a low-income home in the heart of a white neighborhood in Springfield Gardens, Queens. We were known in the block as the family with the money. One day, my mother calls me into the kitchen. She's sitting there, regal, looking like a true Latina. I want to teach you how to make arroz con gandules because I don't want you killing my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Now, this was very rare for me to have that bonding time with my mother. So as she was orchestrating how to prepare the ingredients, I felt a sense of bonding. And there were three questions I always wanted to ask my mother. Mommy, do white women coochie look like our coochie? My mother looked at me like I had grown two heads. The only thing I knew about sex was my mother tell me, don't let a boy touch your skirt. I was 13. Mommy, is the white... Child, what shit are you asking me? My mother says. Child, pussy is pussy. She used the big girl's words, you know? So I'm feeling good now. So, okay, I'm going to ask her my second question. Mommy, aren't you afraid that you might go to jail, what you're doing? So my mother looks at me like she was surprised, but she wasn't. And again, in her Latina, African, Cuban, well, let me tell you something, child. I work for the mafia. They ain't gonna let nothing happen to your mama. Now, for some reason, I knew that from the barrio, there were some bad motherfuckers, but that made me feel good. So I felt that I gotta ask her my burning question. Mommy, don't you think that what you're doing, you might go to hell? Now, if you ever seen a cobra snake in film or picture, how they just stand up and they just have those dark eyes before they strike, that's how my mother looked. Let me tell you something, child. You don't know what it is to be a woman in these days. I hope in your generation it's different, but women today don't have no right, especially if you're colored. You need a man for everything, to open a bank account, to buy a house. A man can beat you to death. Ain't nothing gonna happen to him. You can't tell me what I'm doing is wrong. A woman, she get pregnant. The man don't want to marry her. She can't stay in her home. She's going to be labeled a whore. She can't walk. She's going to have to leave. And if she has the baby, they're going to put on his birth certificate, bastard, giving him a whole life of hardship and trouble. You know why we find women dead in their apartment? They're too afraid to go to the hospital. If a white doctor say you did something, or your boyfriend, or the bum say you did something, they can arrest you, charge you for murder, give you 25 years in some cases, give you the death sentence. So don't tell me what I'm doing is wrong. I just give these women a choice in their time of trouble. Well, I just put the cover back on. Covered it up. I sat down and we talked about how to make the perfect rice. When I was 15, I wasn't feeling well, and I was in the kitchen. And my mother walks in, and she looks at me, and she stops abruptly, and like she's a scanner. You're pregnant. You've been messing with boys. I was experimenting. Well, you better make up your mind before it's too late. That's when I learned the word abortion. And I had a choice. As I sat on my mother's bed, and she came in with the red pod in the bag, and as I felt the warm liquid enter my uterus, I took a deep breath, and I exhaled, and I said, I'm a big girl now.
The ability to ask good questions is one of the main skills that you can use to keep a conversation going. So let's get some practice.
Mommy, do white women coochie look like our coochie? White women coochie, white women coochie, white women coochie. Her poo-poo did not look like my poo-poo. White women coochie, white women coochie. Her poo-poo was infected with rats. Was decaying, but I loved it. Her poo-poo was changing. White women poo-poo. But let's put it this way. The monster from the White Lagoon. White women poochie.
White women
poochie. Mommy, do white women poochie look like...
Child, what shit are you asking me?
I was sitting in the library doing some homework, and I see Josh come walking by. Oh my God, what a babe. He is such a dreamboat. He is fat, hairy, Jewish, and my Jewish mother would have been so proud of me. He comes up to me, and he's just like, Aaliyah, can we talk really quick? Yeah, of course. Anything you want, Josh. We had been seeing each other, like hanging out as friends, just for a little bit, and I was just really starting to like him. Oh my God, he's so funny, he's so cute, and I was in my early 20s and I've never had a boyfriend, and I was really hoping that Josh would be the first boyfriend. So he's like, Aaliyah, let's talk. And I was like, yeah, of course, anything you want. And he's like, I just wanted to say that I really like spending time with you. I think that you're a really cool girl. We have such fun together. But I just have to focus on school right now. I'm about to graduate college, and I'm just worried that I just can't give you the energy that you need, just for right now. Darn. I got the friend speech. I was really hoping that Josh wasn't going to give me the friend speech. So I responded the way that I've always responded when someone gives me the friend speech. I just go, okay, yeah, no, I totally understand. Later that night, I started to think, my selective thinking is coming in. All I heard was, let's just put a pin on this right now. And we'll be friends right now, but give it some time and then maybe we could try it again. So I devised a scheme. My friends have always told me I'm so much more fun when I drink. I'm definitely a square and I live a sober life. So I wanted to have fun with Josh and I wanted to show him what I was all about. So I gave him a couple weeks to think about it, and I invited him over to my apartment. I don't clean too much in my apartment because I'm lazy. And so I was like, I'm going to clean my apartment. I'm going to get hors d'oeuvres For Josh, I put, by hors d'oeuvres, I mean chips and candy. I was like, oh my God, he's gonna fall in love with me. I get the best pot and the best vanilla vodka that you could find, and I invited him over for some bad TV. Josh comes over. Oh my gosh, he's so hot. And we just start shooting the shit, honestly. Like, we just start having fun. We start smoking the ganj, and we put on the first season of Rock of Love. Because I support Bret Michaels' choices in women. We just start laughing. We're having a good time. I bring out the alcohol, and I just start pounding shots left and right. I don't even remember how many shots I took. I was just having so much fun. A little bit later in the night, I was like, Josh, let's dance. Let's dance. And he said, yes, let's do that. So I put on the best of the Bee Gees, Saturday Night Fever, hi. And I just start showing off my moves in front of him. I started to get my swerve on. I was peacocking all in front of him. I was ruffling his feathers, honestly. And I just started getting my groove on. It was so much fun. I open my eyes. And I look around. I have no idea where I am. I look to my left, and I see a heart monitor. I see that it's attached to me. I look to my right, and I see a nurse sitting beside me. I look at her, and I go, where am I? What happened? And she's like, oh my God, you're finally awake. What? And I said, what happened? I don't understand what happened. And she's like, well, you came in last night in an ambulance with alcohol poisoning. What? Really? The first thought that I was thinking was, oh my God, I don't know how much alcohol I intook. Like, how do I not know? And then I started to really think about it, and I was like, oh my God, what did I do in front of Josh? What did I say? What did I do? Is he mad at me? Oh my God, I can't believe I did this. So I took a taxi home, and I'm in front of my door, and I open the door, and the most violent puke smell was just entering my nostrils. I look around my once clean apartment, and it is disheveled. There are papers everywhere. There's garbage all over the place. The chips and the alcohol are still on the table. The couch has been moved. There's puke all over the place. What the fuck happened? And I knew the only person that knew what happened would be Josh. And I don't want to call him. I don't want to do that. He's going to tell me he hates me and that he never wants to talk to me again. But I had to muster up the courage. So I called Josh up. And I said, hey, Josh, it's Aaliyah. And he was like, oh my God, Aaliyah, are you okay? I'm so worried about you. Oh, he cared. That's really sweet. I'm fine, Josh. I just got back from the hospital. I'm just really confused at what happened. Could you enlighten me? And Josh proceeded to tell me what happened. So while I was getting my swerve on to the beach, I fell to the ground and I hit my head. Now, we don't know if the alcohol was just coming back to me or if I just like really hit my head hard. but I couldn't get back up. And he tried to wake me up, and I just stopped responding. And then I started to puke on myself. And then he got really scared, and then he moved me to the couch. And he's tried to wake me up again, and I started to puke on myself more. And then I completely blacked out. And that's when he called the ambulance. Wow. It was so embarrassing. I can't believe that I did that in front of Josh. I can't believe that I embarrassed myself in front of him. Josh and I tried to hang out again. It's really hard to hang out with someone when you've like puked on yourself multiple times and ended yourself in the hospital. But I knew that I had to start to work on myself and start to understand, who do I want to date? I had to start to love myself a little bit more. So I found myself at a party a couple years ago, or 2 years later, excuse me. And I see a boy. He's fat, bald, hairy, not Jewish, but he was so nice and so friendly, and we had so much in common. I started to really fall for him, and he started to fall for me, and he eventually became my first boyfriend. Thank you.
That is all for this week's episode, folks. This is, of course, the Bee Gees behind me now. I always did think this was just a kooky song. And before that, we heard from Aaliyah Liebenow, a story she shared at the Risk Live show in Portland, Oregon. That one was edited by Hope Brosh. And you can find Aaliyah Liebenow on Instagram at Pretty Cool Dudette, with cool being K-E-W-L. You can, of course, find all the information about all the storytellers and musicians involved in the show if you just go to the listen pages at risk-show.com. Folks, did you know that we teach storytelling too? Our school is at thestorystudio.org. We do one-on-one training. We do workshops that you can take online with other students. You can get some of our video classes and take them in your own time. You can hire us to work with your staff or your team. Our custom-tailored workshops that we do for businesses are always hugely popular. That is all at thestorystudio.org. And I do one-on-one training as well. You can look me up at kevinallison.com. Don't forget to follow us on our socials. We're at Risk Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm at The Kevin Allison on Twitter and Instagram. And anything else you need to know about us is at risk-show.com. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk. This is that is